Hello and welcome to Lead Your Mark. I'm your host, Scott Gleason, and this is where I explore the influences that have shaped the lives of our incredible guests. These are the stories of lives worth talking about. Follow me on Twitter at @BitByScott and Instagram at @KingOfHang, or link up with me on my Facebook fan page, Scott G. Livingston. My goal is to empower and inspire a community of people who take every opportunity to live a high-performing life. Before I get started on today's podcast, I want to take a moment to connect you with my sponsor, ReconditioningHQ.com. If you're a therapist of any kind listening today, have you ever found yourself wondering why your patient's issue is not resolving or why it keeps coming back? If you're someone who helps people achieve their health, fitness, or performance goals, have you ever struggled with their pain getting in the way of success or wondered why they keep reaching plateaus they can't overcome? Or maybe if you're in either of these worlds, you view the other world as uncomfortable territory, a space where your abilities end and your need to trust is challenged. Reconditioning is the place where these worlds intersect, the place where each world becomes tangible and familiar, where misunderstanding and fear of the wrong move are replaced with confidence and creativity. The reconditioning process is powerful. It's provocative, and it has become a sought-after capacity in the human performance world. In the first week of September, ReconditioningHQ.com releases the R-Pro series, a four-step turnkey process to integrating the worlds of therapy and performance. Four steps, one mission, to make you the reconditioning professional everyone wants to work with. For more information about the R-Pro series or any one of our empowering courses, head over to ReconditioningHQ.com and use the coupon code RPRO2021 to get $50 off any one of our products and take advantage of our free 5 hours video that takes you through our groundbreaking method of improving mobility. I'm excited to have my friend Brad Thorpe and his company ISOFIT involved with the Leave Your Mark podcast. His mission is the same as mine, helping human beings live better lives. He doesn't want to see you let an injury force your retirement from the sport or activity you love. For decades, physiotherapists, athletic therapists, and chiropractors have recommended isometric strength training to help speed up rehabilitation from injury and included it in return to sport protocols. I know I use it often in my own reconditioning process. Whether your goal is performance enhancement, injury prevention, or injury recovery, the all-new ISOFIT MSK takes athletes from the therapy room to the podium. To learn more, visit www.isofit, that's ISOFIT with a PHITMSK.ca, and remember to use the discount code LEAVEYOURMARK, three separate words, to save $500 off your ISOFIT MSK purchase. I want to thank Greg Lawler and Matrix Fitness for being a long-standing sponsor of the Leave Your Mark podcast. Matrix is indeed leaving a mark on the fitness and performance industry today. In the last 20 years, Matrix has become a global brand that employs over 7,000 people worldwide and delivers over 500 products catering to the medical, fitness, and athletic performance markets. Matrix has a wide range of programming solutions, and they are dedicated to creating deeper partnerships with their customers everywhere. Matrix has many ways of making a relationship work for you, the customer, and offers rental and various financial incentives to assist the financial constraints of adding premium equipment during this time of inconsistent revenue. For more information and free consultation, go to teamupwithmatrix.com/CA. That's teamupwithmatrix.com/CA today. Hello and welcome to Leave Your Mark. I'm Scott Livingston, and today I have the opportunity to speak with Jesse Wright. Jesse is the founder of the Balance the Bar Initiative, a high-performance consultant, coach, author, and public speaker. His career has spanned over two decades in the team sport culture, including work with organizations in the NBA, NFL, NCAA, and in private sports training. His passion lies in helping young professionals grow and advance in their careers and lives. Through continuing education resources and private coaching, he seeks to create awareness, recognition, and comprehensive solutions for both professional and personal development. Jesse most recently spent 14 years with the Philadelphia 76ers of the NBA, first as the head strength conditioning coach, and then as the director of performance science. During his time in professional basketball, he was named the NBA strength conditioning coach of the year in 2013. He also served as president of the National Basketball Strength Conditioning Association from 2013 to 2015. Wright has held strength conditioning coach positions with Temple University, the Philadelphia Eagles, the Barcelona Dragons, Hofstra University football, and St. Joseph University. He also served as director of Summit Sports Training Center. Above all his accomplishment, Jesse is also a father, which makes him most proud. I am honored to have him on the show today. Welcome, Jesse.
Thank you for so much for having me on. It's going to be great to get a chance to catch up and chat.
Yeah, it's good to reconnect. We reconnected a few weeks ago, and that was the precipitator of me having you on the podcast. You've done a lot in your career, and that's what I try to open up to the listenership, is just bring perspectives from a lot of different angles of people's, what they've been influenced by, but what the journey they've lived has been. So I usually go back and sort of start with the beginning to sort of understand where people came from. So you grew up where, and what were sort of the big influences on you at the time, family-wise or life-wise?
Yeah, I grew up in Pennsylvania, about an hour and a half north of Philadelphia, a town called Easton, Pennsylvania. And Easton is famous for first Crayola crayons, right, that everybody colors with, right? And Larry Holmes, the Easton Assassin, right? Wow. Former heavyweight champion. Probably the two most known exports out of that town.
Did you ever meet Larry?
I probably shook his hand as a young kid. I think that's based on my age. I was just too young to really appreciate like the celebrity and the buzz around the heavyweight champion in the town. I remember my parents, this is way before pay-per-view and everything. I think you could catch maybe boxing events, maybe on HBO if you had it, or maybe a USA. But I remember my parents having some get-togethers when he fought. But never, a little too young to appreciate his heyday. I did, however, go to high school and know a number of his relatives, played football with one of his nephews, and he has a deep legacy in that town and still lives there, owns a bunch of real estate and gives back to the town and everything. Yeah, really cool story.
Very cool. Yeah. So you're growing up there, and when you're growing up there, what are you dreaming of being?
Yeah, so this is hilarious. I said this in another interview. When I was really young, if you take the 4-year-old version of me, I told everybody I wanted to be a turkey doctor. Right? I have no clue where I came from. My mom, she passed a couple of years ago, and she used to love telling that story. Inevitably, when, hey, what did you want to be when you wanted to grow up? For some reason, I came up with that, and she loved telling people that, and it just kind of has lived on as like my young statement legacy.
You used to have a lot of turkeys running around in your backyard?
Apparently. I have no idea. Yeah. And apparently they needed some help. So they needed a doctor and medical care. Yeah.
We have a lot of turkeys we live out in the country up in Canada. We have wild turkeys walking in our backyard all the time, but I now understand why they became the pilgrim's go-to meal, because they don't move very quickly.
Yeah, sure. Easily catchable, right?
Yeah. So are you a school kid, a sports kid, or are you a combination of both as you're going, growing up, or what's your big influence?
Yeah, it was both. So fast forward to high school years, and I was the undersized high school football player that, played everything growing up, but then got to high school and wanted to focus on that sport, and realized that as an undersized athlete, I needed to train a little bit, right? And hopefully, add a little bit of mass and get a lot stronger for what I wanted to accomplish on the field. So I actually got involved in powerlifting in the off season. That was kind of like my second sport. And it was my first exposure to structured training, right? We trained with a local power lifter who was about my size. So I kind of identified it. He was a master's deadlift national record holder. And I think he competed at 160, and this guy was just wired. You know what I mean? Veins up and down his arm. And I think he had a PhD in nutritional science. So he actually had his own supplement line. And he was a big influence at that time in my life in the off season. And I saw what a structured program could do. And I saw the attention to detail with respect to, building those three events. And it really got me into and interested in program design, right? Mm-hmm. And just this notion that you can help improve the skills of a football player not playing football, right, in the mm-hmm. offseason mm-hmm. and everything. So that is when I kind of set my sights on being somehow tied to a training field. And initially it was physical therapy, and that's where I sought out my degree at Temple University. It was a bachelor's in exercise science, but took all the prereqs that I needed at the time to apply to a graduate program in physical therapy.
Were mom and dad big advocates of education, wanted you to go to university, or were, you know, what was their influence on you in the time?
Big on education for sure. Neither of them went to college, so it wasn't one of those where you just follow suit, and I was groomed to be, you know, just follow those footsteps, but it was more like go the other way. Like, we didn't go to college, so we're going to make sure that you guys do, right? And, you know, and that was kind of the tone for my brother and sister. Although my mom hated the powerlifting component of it, just hated it. It represented everything she thought was horrible for a young kid. And I remember bringing her home a video of the first competition I went to. And I competed as a 148 at the time. And I think I had like a 175 squat or a 185 squat, nailed it, got all three white lights. And I was so proud to like show her, saying, and she hated it. Absolutely hated it. Yeah. So she didn't care for that. But to your question, it was about, you know, education, do what you have to do to get into a reputable college.
So you get into college. What's the hardest thing about going to school for you at that time?
At that time, it was, I had decided not to play sports in college, right? Mm-hmm. So again, high school football player, and you know, my size and weight wasn't going to play anything in America other than a Division III program and talent level, I should say. So I chose not to, and just went to a large university, Temple in Philadelphia. And initially it was like, how am I going to carve my path, right? Mm-hmm. In Temple's program, they have a tremendous cardiac unit, right? Known for their heart surgeries, right? At their hospital and everything. So the biggest part of their exercise science program was preparing their students for cardiac rehab. Mm-hmm. And, you know, saw that early on in the degree. And I didn't have intentions to take it in that direction. So how can you somehow take your coursework and move towards athletics? You know, the mm-hmm. personal training option is always there. Commercial gym option is always there, but how can you get involved in athletics? And luckily, this wasn't at all intentional, but I ended up meeting a couple guys that worked for the football team at Temple mm-hmm. University, and they were student equipment managers. And I ended up on their flag football team by coincidence, and a couple games in, they're like, hey, you should, you know, test, you know, come and work with us. And a couple weeks later, I'm, you know, on a plane to East Carolina University on the sideline of a Division I football program. And, you know, the biggest part of that job was laundry and, you know, jock straps and rolling equipment out onto the field and all that stuff. Yeah, and it was a little toenail in the door in major athletics. Right. And so that was kind of, you know, the goal at that point was, how can you take the exercise science and somehow get into athletics? And mm-hmm. that was the bridge. That was the bridge. I was a student equipment manager.
Very cool. Well, yeah. I want to unpack as we go through this a little bit with your experiences. You just wrote a book called The Intent is to Grow. And, you know, for those listening, maybe you can highlight where people can find it. But because it's about, you know, the human, it's a story about human growth and going through things, and you write it in sort of a storyteller's way. I haven't been able to read all of it, but I got into it a little bit last night. When you look back at school with a different set of lenses, do you remember either the advantage taking moments that you had for your own personal growth, or the things that maybe you missed that you could have taken advantage of when you were going through school, with looking back now with different set of lenses?
Yeah, it's a great question. And it's almost the origin of why I've chosen to go in this direction of, you know, call it awareness, call it recognition of this soft skill set, this really critically important skill set that anyone that spent any amount of time in a high performance environment, high performance sport, or nearly every other industry, you know, you recognize that certainly a huge component of what you do to be a high-level practitioner or employee or anywhere is what you know, those hard skills, comes from your degree or your advanced degree or your advanced training, certifications, everything. Always the foundation of what we do as practitioners. But there's this whole other skill set that is tied to the human being that you are, that gives you the opportunity to have real impact, long-term, lasting, sustainable success. And again, our world is high-performance sport, right? And you see people come and go when they're deficient in this skill set, and you see people that earn more and more contracts and promotions when they're really good. And I saw that a lot. I saw that a lot in the environment with the Sixers that I worked in for the last 14 years, and then even some of the other teams that I worked with prior. So to answer your question directly, as you see all of that, and you see this the power in those skills, and we're talking again leadership and communication and self-awareness and, you know, empathy and compassion and cultural awareness and all these things that don't come from the degree. You don't learn those things in your coursework that you choose at university. They are typically learned as you spend more time in the field, as you model after others that are really good at it, as maybe some reflection or some recognition. Again, if someone didn't last, you start asking, you know, what happened there? Why are they no longer with us? Why was their contract not renewed? Or why was that hard decision made? And you start having some conversations and they're like, well, they didn't play well in the sandbox with others, right? And didn't, couldn't connect with athletes, right? The athletes didn't necessarily seek them out for help. And when they did, they didn't necessarily deliver. There was a missing connection. And you start seeing really firsthand on both sides of those, just how powerful that skill set is. So, you know, to wrap all of that into your answer, the core message and the intent behind the book, to play on the title or whatever, was to increase awareness. You know, I'm not the first to do this. I'm not the only one to do this, not by any stretch. However, continue to build on this notion that this is a skill set that can and should be developed to be a really impactful practitioner in our world.
So do you remember during your early, more formative career years, and it doesn't have to be in college, but it can be beyond that, somebody who you look back on? Because I find sometimes with regard to this conversation, I want to unpack this as we go along, because I think it's the value proposition and all of this, for especially for a younger person. Do you recall now, looking back, or even at the time, somebody that you saw who did it right and it kind of struck you at the time, and even without recognizing your that as an influence at the time, you recognize it as an influence now? So you worked with somebody, you saw the way they did things, you were, because I find when younger people are in school, to your point, and that's kind of where I want to go with this, we're being told, hey, you got to learn all the technical, you got to know this stuff, you got to be good. And nobody's really saying, oh, look over here at this. Do you see what this person's doing in terms of the way they're conversing and talking? Mm-hmm. We learn that almost osmotically, or we don't, right? Mm-hmm. And so when you look back, was there this osmotic moment where you kind of remember this coach or this therapist or this professional kind of, you were struck by the way that they deported themselves?
Yeah, without a doubt. You go back to the high school years, you can pick out teachers, right? We're wired to go to coaches and sports and everything, but you look at some of the teachers that you truly remember the environment that they brought to the classroom every single day that empowered you to learn more so than others. Mm-hmm. And you start to pick apart again now as 40-something, 50-something year old practitioners looking back, you start to pick apart, why was that the case? Why are some memorable versus others? Mm-hmm. And it goes to really the way they carry themselves in the environment that they set up, for sure. Mm-hmm. They probably, again, looking back, they were people that went above and beyond, and they made themselves available, maybe extra time. Right. Maybe if mom is late for picking you up and you know she's going to be late, is way before cell phones or anything, but you know, you're standing out in front of the gym and no one's there, it's like, hey, you know, I'll drop you off. Just, you know, don't, you know, little above and beyond type things, right? Go pick you up. I'll pick you up for practice, or I'll help you. I'll make sure that you understand, extra time, right? Dedicated. I'll make sure that you understand this, offense that we're going to run this week for the upcoming opponent or something. So that was a big one. To go back to the powerlifting coach I referenced before, we trained in his basement, right? He made his home available, right? He had a deadlift bar, a couple barbells and a squat rack in his basement. And that's where we started training, right? In his basement. And that was significant. You see somebody open their doors like that, and they, that's much more than somebody that just maybe met you at a gym somewhere or something. And then fast forward to the high performance environment, the team environments that I've had the fortunate opportunity to work in. And man, you see those coaches that really resonate, that the players walk into a room or a building or a facility and they seek them out, right? Mm-hmm. Could be, again, our world. You walk into a training room and they're going to one person for their MOBs. Right. Mm-hmm. They don't really want to deal with anybody else. And it's probably first and foremost because they're a really good practitioner. They know their stuff, guaranteed. But it's also like, what do they talk about when they're on the table? Right. Mm-hmm. Are they a likable person? Are they a person that has demonstrated the ability to develop a relationship, sustain a relationship, and maybe do more than others in terms of serving that athlete and helping them get better in whatever it is they need to get better at. In this example, it's just improving ankle mobility, right? Or prepping them for a practice. But there's probably other settings that you maybe don't even see. You know, they're probably, maybe they talked about something, some TV show at night while they're on the table, while they're in the heart of the professional relationship. But you know as well as I do, in between sets and when somebody's on the table and everything, conversation drifts in a bunch of different directions. Maybe they talked about a TV show or some type of character or some type of, you know, public event that's going on. And then later on that night at 9:30, you're watching it on TV or you see some tweet about it and you just, you know, forward a screenshot or forward a little video, right? And it's all about that relationship and that connection. And it makes that athlete, it makes that client want to continue to engage with that person. And again, to answer your question directly, you look back at the really memorable, impactful coaches and leaders and teachers that I had and that many of us had in our younger lives. They probably were really good at those types of things.
So as you're building your acumen, you know, at some point you can sort of segue where you want to into where you get into your first, you know, real high performance environment. What strikes you about that, or what do you find you have to step up to that maybe you didn't recognize before actually getting dropped into that space?
Yeah, I got some really good advice from one of the senior equipment managers who still to this day remains a really good friend of mine. And he's like, let me give you some advice. You're brand new. You're working for a Division I football team. Just keep your mouth shut and work hard. Right. That was his way of saying just fit in. Right. And it brings about this element of cultural awareness, which I actually talk about in the book. Right. You are in a brand new environment. What do you do to recognize how to quote unquote fit in, right? Not stand out in the wrong way and become critically aware pretty quickly about how you can be a good teammate and understand your role and deliver on whatever it is, your objectives that you need to be part of that team. So that was a big one. Never having been around a Division I football environment, like I didn't know what to do to get on a plane. Like where do you sit? Right? What do you do? Like, you walk into a team meeting room or a training table, you walk into a post-practice meal. And that was real. I remember this my first week because practice took you past the time when the cafeteria was open for regular students. So they kept a little room out in the back and everything. And you walk in, you're like, what? I know how to eat. Right. I certainly know how to consume meals, but I don't know how to do it around a bunch of football players and coaches. Like, this is pretty big time. What do I do? How do I act in this environment? And, you know, I just decided to, again, just follow others, right? And stay in people's pockets and just, you know, you look around, and you're like, okay, I'll just do what other people do. But that's a tactic. It's a cultural awareness tactic to figure out how do you fit in? And, you know, you could take that same model and apply it to new jobs, even on a higher level, right? Because the thing about cultural awareness and being skillful in that area, that attribute, is that you can't just assume that what you did in the previous environment, even if it's the exact same title, the exact same role, and you've done it, you can't just assume that what you did in the previous world is going to work in your new one. There's a lot of corporate knowledge for sure. Like, you are more prepared than someone that's never done it before, but there's new expectations. There's new cultural norms. There's new standards. And again, don't be the guy that walks in with your shirt untucked on a team of a head coach that thinks that's disrespectful and everybody tucks their shirts in. It's small examples, but that stuff's real. You don't want to make the wrong impression early. So
yeah, I think that's amazing.
Yeah, that awareness was a big one for me. And I did. I just chose to really, you know, stay low key, stay in the background, and just kind of watch and see what other people do. Yeah, and it served me well, you know, and I probably misstepped a bunch of times and didn't know it either. But luckily it wasn't too glaring that I was able to, you know, kind of continue in the environments that I was in and learn a little bit more.
Yeah, well, I, you know, maybe segue forward to when you start getting into more, I call it leadership situations. So you've gone through your cultural awareness process and you've kind of now gained credibility in the space. And now maybe you're the veteran guy who's there. How did you act as a leader to take a younger person or a newer person and clarify for them what cultural awareness is and where to, you know, like the equipment manager did for you, what is that messaging that you brought to the table for somebody younger as well?
Yeah, that's been a big one for me. I've always felt, you know, obligated is probably a strong word, maybe the responsibility to, whether you call it pay it forward or give back, just like those above us gave to us at some point in our early 20s and everything, that, you know, when you have a young practitioner, particularly like take maybe some of the new younger employees that came in as like interns to the Sixers or somebody like that, whether they came in as strength conditioning or athletic training, and a really intimidating environment might be when you do get to go on your first road trip, right? Because that's, you know, it's a whole new world that, you know, you get on a chartered flight, right? And you walk into a Ritz-Carlton, a 5-star hotel, right? And you're traveling around with this team. What do you do? How do you carry yourself? So I did feel a responsibility, you know, so it can work both ways, because sometimes maybe, you know, in a safe and playful way, you like purposely lead them down the wrong path. And you know, as kind of like a hazing, like let's get the new guy type thing, you know, obviously nothing too critical, but just like, you know, orient them to the road in a playful way. But the bigger part of it is let's make sure that they don't misstep, right? Because they are, you know, if they're a teammate and they're in your world, they're a reflection of the department and you want to make sure they do well. So it's like make sure they know, you know, make sure they know how to get to the airport. like, how about that? Don't be late to the flight. What time do we all arrive to the flight? Because an 11 o'clock departure probably doesn't mean arrive at 11, right? We know that, but it's also not 2 hours before and security and all that stuff. Like there's a sequence, right? And there's a structure to mm-hmm. you know, a team flight or something. So when do you arrive? Where do you go? Where does the, you know, how does security work there? And you give them a little bit of heads up on that, so they do that well. And then, you know, you walk onto the plane and where do you sit? you know as well as I do, right? On team buses and team flights and everything, there's probably unwritten designated seats. And don't sit in somebody's veteran seat as the brand new face, right? The FNG on the flight. Nobody knows you. Nobody's seen you before. Don't sit in a veteran seat. That's going to be a painful moment for you, probably. And I say that, right? And I'm joking about this because I made that mistake, you know, with some points and everything. Because nobody told me where to sit. So, you know, yeah. And particularly if it's some imposing presence, he's going to tap me on the shoulder and say, get the F out of my seat. Who the hell are you? right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's fun, right? And those are fun stories to tell looking backwards, but you don't want to be the guy in that position. So you get out in front of it with a younger person, you know, and then what do you do about eating and what do you do once the flight's there and everything? And then, plane's going to land. And what do you do when you get on the bus? And then the transition from bus to hotel. And then what do we do when we all get to the new city? Is there a meeting? Is there a, what do we do for dinner? And, all the that type of etiquette and everything. Yeah. So again, to be able to pass that knowledge down to a newcomer, and that's just one team travel example. Mm-hmm. There are many other examples, right? When you're in a team environment or when you're new to an activity or a game day, for instance, or something like that, there's a whole other set of expectations and norms that you would want to pass down to somebody so they arrive successfully and they get off on the right foot. Right. And I have always felt the responsibility to contribute to that on some level.
I want to take the 76ers role, because you were there for a while, first sort of walk into it. How do you get involved in that team? And then what I'd like to sort of play with a little bit is managing change within it. But, how do you get the role, and what's your initial responsibility and sort of position dynamics in the beginning?
Yeah, I had an interesting path to the NBA because I was actually working for a private sports training center at the time. We had it was called Summit Sports Training Center. It was owned by a pretty reputable sports agent, right? Actually, the biggest part of his clientele is in the NHL. A lot of Canadians, right? He represented over the years. And he owned a series of training centers, and he negotiated some pretty high-level strength and conditioning contracts in the Philadelphia area. So at one point, we were the strength coaches for St. Joe's University. And then we moved on and we got the contract with the 76ers. So I was placed in that contract while working for another organization and did that for 4 years as a consultant. Mm-hmm. And then 2010 came, and Doug Collins was the head coach at the time. He was just brand new to the position, and it's the team made the decision that they didn't want the strength and conditioning position to be an outside contract anymore, that they wanted to bring their own guy under the logo and make it a full-time position and everything. And I transitioned from consultant to full-time with the team. So 14 total years. Nine of those were as the head strength coach, but four of those were as a consultant. So mm-hmm. 4 + 5 as a strength coach, and then, moved into the performance science role. So the initial job as a consultant in this, pay your dues in the NBA, I was incredibly fortunate to be assigned to that contract. And but it wasn't just an NBA job at the time. I still had real responsibilities at the training center. So on practice days, I would go back and handle all the roles and responsibilities of a performance coach, right? And train all of the clients that the training center had. And while I was with the team and wore that hat, it was the traditional strength and conditioning coach role for the team, responsible for program design for all of the players. Didn't have any help. There were no interns and no assistant roles or anything like that. In fact, at that point, the medical and performance department was a solid 4 people deep. For an NBA team, right? You had two athletic trainers, myself as the head strength coach, and a full-time soft tissue therapist. And that was it. We contracted out our physical therapy. We contracted out our nutrition, contracted out your sports psych, and the internal team was 4 people deep. Mm. And, you saw when you came to our building, you saw the advancement of that pretty quickly, right? Now go to like 2013, 2014, and we started growing. And from that point forward, all of a sudden we quadrupled in size in a 4-year period. We went from 4 to 16. Yeah. And that's just kind of a reflection of a lot of the direction where a lot of the teams are going, right? More personnel and a more detailed approach to the athletes.
Well, that's interesting. I want to unpack that a little bit because sort of around the managing change thing, but there are advantages and disadvantages to each sort of circumstance. When you have a smaller team, you're more intimate, you're more connected, you to some degree play off one another. Then you start the so-called ideal strategy, as some people might perceive, is to have more players who have greater acumen and come in, and so you've got kind of this all-star team. But I guess what I'm interested in is the perception is that we should there's always the perception when we put together something in performance that we should have a group of all-stars together. And this kind of goes to your comment around the human, call it EQ side of things, right? As we go after, you know, whether it's the great massage practitioner, the great manual therapist, the high-tech strength guy who's got the great rep and stuff. But this is where team dynamics start to really shift. And I'm interested in your experience where there might, you might be really good at what you do, but you're not good at working in an environment that is a performance environment and sharing your toys or collaborating or integrating, et cetera, which is really what team is about. And this is, I think, what has become the struggle probably over the last 10 years of most performance environments is how do you salt and pepper this in a way where everybody works together versus you start to get your silos, which already exist there, even more, you know, entrenched. So how did you manage that change? What did you see? And what have you learned around that that you've taken away from it?
And again, another great question. And it's probably context specific, depending on the team and the environment and everything. I mean, everybody does things differently based on the needs of the team and, you know, who's been hired where and how quickly they grow and everything. But my own personal experience, go to the four-man group, right? When we were four, a team of generalists, right? You don't even have enough time. You're trying to manage everything with respect to the athletes and your the role that you play on the performance and medical team, and you barely have time to argue. You very rarely have time to meet and game plan and all that stuff, right? You're just doing the job all the time. You got guys you got to lift in the weight room before and after practice, and sometimes guys show up early and sometimes they miss their pre-practice lift, so you got to stay after practice when you didn't know. And again, me being the only guy, I was the only one to cover that. So if I wasn't there, guys didn't lift.
Right.
Or, you know, and this is, you would never want this, but they go into the room on their own and now you have safety issues and lack of guidance and structure and coaching and cueing and everything. So that's not the route you want to go. But, you know, when you have that, you very much recognize that we're all going to have to do a lot of different things, maybe slightly outside of our job description to function on a high level. So that's where, and again, you know, the strength coach usually is asked and tasked with being involved in nutrition, supplementation, and he might take on a return to play role, right? You're probably not early stage rehab, but you know, as he starts creeping back towards getting on the court or the field, right? Maybe that strength coach would take on an earlier role than if we had a full-time physical therapist on staff, right? So I was asked to learn and contribute to that. Early on, you might be the guy that's working around the injury site, but maybe your engagement, you know, possibly earlier in the return to play stages with respect to the injury site, maybe, and be knowledgeable enough to do that and do it effectively. And, you know, and then you just go into like the, again, just as you look at the different needs of a team that maybe you might have to help out with travel planning or insight in a hotel, or you arrive at a hotel. And this is where, again, the good teammate thing comes in and everything. When you're small staffed, like, you know, don't be too proud to carry some luggage and unload a truck, right? If that's what it takes. And particularly when you're leaving a city and you know, you got a 2-hour flight home and the goal is to have the players recover and get to sleep as quickly as possible, that of course we could all sit on the plane and watch the cargo crew do the bags, the cargo crew of three people deep, or we can all go out and load bags quicker and get on the flight earlier and we all get home a half hour earlier, right? Now we all sleep better and it's better for the players and everything. So I'd put that all under the category of generalists. Like be open to being a fluid and adaptable enough teammate to stretch outside of maybe what your current job description would entail. And now you fast forward, now the department grows. And now again, let's say you have if it's our model, like all of a sudden you have 16 people where there used to be four and you move to specialists, right? Now you have very targeted roles that don't necessarily involve stretching outside of them to be a good teammate in that environment. And in that model, you have to knock your own specific role out of the park regularly all the time and might not need to stretch too far out of it. Right. you know, again, I know you spoke with Todd Wright a couple weeks ago on the pod, right? And, and we brought Todd in, and all of a sudden our strength and conditioning department was four people deep under Todd's direction. And I wasn't even one of them, right? I moved over into sports science under David Martin, right? So, you know, what was a one man show for a bunch of years all of a sudden became four, right? Mm-hmm. And under Todd's direction and leadership, very much used all four of those people in a really highly effective way to make the coaching and the care that you gave to those athletes in that weight room really super individualized and specialized. That they knew when you walk into that weight room, you're getting a highly effective, coached, high level program, right? And you could have any one of three or four bodies coaching you, right? So there was, again, to be a good teammate in that environment, there wasn't a huge, there were some days I was in the weight room, but there were other days where it was my best role was to step out, right? And maybe work on something else that the team needed. And my contribution was different that day. And that's where, again, you know, a lot of the sports science initiatives that we were just, you know, beginning and growing at that time is really what kind of fell under my responsibilities at that point. And then you had the same thing on the medical side. What used to be two athletic trainers, now all of a sudden you did bring some physical therapist, some experienced physio and physical therapists under the logo. And now there's three or four physical therapists there in addition to two athletic trainers. And how do you divide and conquer them, right? What is the division of labor in those roles and responsibilities? So you're not all stepping on each other's toes when there's athletes in the training room. And right. And it's not all like one guy walks in and there's three people going, what do you need? Right. You know, there takes some planning and some communication. So I say that to become once that environment expands to a bunch of specialists, man, the new challenge is all about what you just said. How are we going to collaborate effectively and make sure that we are on the same page going into every single day with how we run our training room and how we treat our athletes and how we're going to work the pre-practice schedule as they navigate from training room and maybe a prehab type, the prep that they need in that room. And then they move over to the weight room and then you pass them off to the development coaches and making sure everybody's on the same page with that. And we have a common message, right? And that common message that maybe you craft that message in a meeting before the day even starts. You know, whereas the four-man group we were so busy, there weren't necessarily times to meet all the time. Now you almost have to meet ahead of time as a 16-person group or 10 or 12, whatever, and make sure that you develop your message and it's all common and consistent and one voice, so to speak, when you're dealing with the coaches and the athletes. Because you don't want to be divisive and you don't want to say one message to one guy. Meanwhile, he may have heard something different in another room. That's not good for anybody and certainly wouldn't fall under the definition of high performance at all. So to be able to find time to get on common ground and communicate and collaborate, that becomes the new challenge for a much larger group and what a lot of the expanding teams are dealing with right now.
I'm interested off of that. I'll tell you my bias to a degree, and then I'd love to hear your viewpoint, whether it's counter to mine or not. But I'm very much as a performance coach and therapist, I like to work towards autonomy, and I'm an educator versus a deliverer constantly of. And my goal is to make the athletes sort of understand or recognize what it is that they are doing and why they're doing it. And I find in those kinds of environments, it's a very delicate dance between, you know, providing service and making sure people are well tuned and taken care of, and you not making everything so easy that they never really understand why they're there or what they're doing. And so how did you massage, manage that and not make your athletes addicted to care, addicted to, you know, that moment that you just preface where the athlete walks in and, you know, there are three different people ready to work on them and take care of them. And so now they're not doing their own foam rolling. They're not doing their own stretching. They're not doing everything else is sort of delivered to them. So maybe you sit differently on that viewpoint, but I'm just kind of curious, like, you know, how do you balance that? Quick break here, and we'll be back in a couple of seconds with our podcast guest. I've often been asked, how do I do what you do? What books or courses should I take? And for a long time, I had no real answer to that question. Delivering the concepts and practices we now call reconditioning was this compilation of so many ideas, concepts, methods, and strategies. But 7 years ago, Jamie and I set out to answer that very question by creating one systematic process that would help you bring it all together and supercharge the skills and systems you already know. You see, reconditioning is not about excluding anything. No, it's about being inclusive, holistic, proactive, and curious. It's about having an operating system that grows with you and supports you in your human performance practice. We want you to be the reconditioning professional everyone wants to work with so you can determine your value and explore the possibilities of success. For more information about becoming a reconditioning professional today, head over to www.reconditioninghq.com and download the free video explaining our powerful 5 R's practice for improving mobility. A new era of performance training is upon us. Maximize your isometric endurance strength and functional performance with the all-new ISOFIT MSK. No matter what your sport, ISOFIT will help best prepare your body to tolerate the forces associated with it. This not only reduces your chances of sustaining career-limiting injury, it will also enhance your ability to perform at your highest level. I really like what Brad Thorpe and ISOFIT are doing, and I encourage you to learn more about their mission by visiting www.isofit, that's ISOFIT with a PH, msk.ca, so isofitmsk.ca today. And remember to use the discount code LEAVEYOURMARK, 3 separate words, to save $500 off your ISOFIT MSK purchase. Matrix Fitness is about performance innovation, and I'm proud to have them with me on the Leave Your Mark podcast. They recently named my good friend and awesome performance coach, Mark Fitzgerald, as their head of performance team, which is a bold statement for anyone who wants to know they're working with the best. Matrix has all kinds of interesting lines of equipment. The Matrix Glute Trainer addresses the discomfort, inefficiency, and danger of working with loaded barbell during hip thrusts. The Matrix Glute Trainer accommodates resistance bands and weight resistance and is customizable to different body types and sizes, endorsed by many and comes at a cost below others on the market. The Matrix S-Drive is a sprint performance treadmill that supports sprint training, resisted sled pulls, and pushes all on the frame of a standard treadmill. The 7 feet by 3 foot footprint of the S-Drive is non-motorized and is perfect for coaches who do not have access to a track or want to provide coaching in real time with the athlete. The non-motorized feature and flexibility in a simple machine keeps benefits high and investment low. For more information or a free consult, go to teamupwithmatrix.com/CA today. We're back. Enjoy the rest of this podcast.
Yeah. I won't tell you that, you know, we as a department with the Sixers, you know, had it nailed, right? That we did it perfectly all the time. But the NBA environment, the NBA athlete is one that does, you know, probably by product of how they grew up, right? There are expectations to get that type of treatment. And it's probably unfair to say NBA. I think that's probably how a lot of professional athletes mm-hmm. are wired, because they mm-hmm. are constantly surrounded by people that are willing to give and do things for them and everything. So it's a tricky balance. You're right. And you don't want to be the guy that's seen as the person that's not willing to help and empower them to get to their own personal goals, because they have the means and opportunity to go and seek out others, right? Mm-hmm. So you don't want to be that guy. So, but you do also want to acknowledge the side that you had, where we can't spoon feed all the time, that, mm-hmm. you know, that autonomy, right, that you mentioned, which is an awesome word, right? And we know from a leadership standpoint, that's kind of what people under you, that's kind of what they desired. They want to be recognized as individuals, and they want to know that their contribution is valuable and that you're helping them, right? Mm-hmm. Go, work towards that contribution. So with respect to that, I think it's a real balance that if you move away from the spoon feeding part of it, right, and doing everything for the athlete, that you find a good balance to help them understand that some of this, that I'm actually helping you developmentally, to not do everything for you, to help you, you know, you brand new rookie that maybe he's a one and done. and maybe his college program didn't lean on him so much to understand, you know, because the one and done, they don't, you know, the schedule's really interesting. You hear 1 year, but it's not really 1 year. It's kind of like a little bit of training time, right? And we're kind of talking weight room here. It's a little bit of training time leading up to the season. Then you fall into like an in-season schedule, mm-hmm. which, you know, doesn't lend itself really well to structured training, at least not, you know, the frequency per week that, that you would get if you were in like a whole off season. Mm-hmm. So I say all of that because maybe a rookie arrives and his weight room IQ isn't too, you know, the training age might be less than one, right? If he was never right. And then the IQ is even probably a little more fundamental than that. So to teach a guy, you know, here's simple things is how you load your weights, right? And how do you set up your own bar, right? And I'm going to tell you what weight I need you to put on there, but I'm with this other guy on the other side of the room. So load your bar. I'll be over to spot you in a second. That's a simple version of it. Mm-hmm. But then you move them towards like, you know, coaching them up on movement patterns, right? And what is your cueing for them to understand and feel, you know, what is a true hip hinge, right? And how do you, you know, you walk into a room and maybe that person is with someone else and you know how to prep yourself to go through your mobility routine or your movement prep or something, and that, you know, that I'm going to teach you to fish versus always handing you the fish. Mm-hmm. And to help the athlete understand that if you see me not being the guy that's always spoon feeding to you, that here's the reason why. And I think it's going to be really good for you that I'm actually trying to help you grow and develop in a way mm-hmm. that maybe others don't choose to or are willing to. Mm-hmm. And if you manage that the right way relationally, I think you can still come out on the other side with a strong connection, with a strong relationship, and maybe accomplish the goals on both sides of that, what the athlete's seeking and what you feel is good for them too.
Yeah, I love that. And it kind of flows into... I'm going to wind this up a little bit in the terms of the idea of adversity. You know, I'm having my own kind of interesting conversations around the, you know, we just came out of the Olympics, and I know there's a lot of interesting stories and there are always interesting stories about the adversity that particular athletes have gone through or to get where they get to or to have the success that they have. And, you know, there's this kind of interesting balance these days between, you know, making everything copacetic for people. And, you know, we see this in our own kids, and this is where I'm kind of going, because you have a 10-year-old and you're a dad now. And it's kind of like, well, on one side of the coin, we'll want to give our kids everything they need to succeed. On the other side of the coin, and our athletes, but on the other side of the coin, this sense of adversity, this sense of having to dig a little bit the ditch or overcome things, always seems to be the message in the background of true success. If somebody's never had adversity, a lot of times, unless they're very special, they don't reach that next level. So I'm curious for you, in writing the book and looking at and being a dad now and being a coach, have you changed your belief systems? How do you see your belief systems now in terms of what giving what somebody needs, but at the same time recognizing that there's adversity and stress dynamics and challenge and everything that they have to go through to actually arrive where they need to arrive at?
Yeah, for sure. You know, becoming a parent, and again, I'm not nearly the first person to say this, but becoming a parent gives you a whole new perspective and thoughts on how to coach an athlete, right? Mm-hmm. Much, mm-hmm. much different, you know, now with a 10-year-old son than I was prior to having a 10-year-old son, right? It just gives you a different viewpoint on how to get through. And I think to answer your question, as I was kind of thinking through my answer, you know, the concept of failing safely, right, is a really interesting one, right? You go to like the skill acquisition guys, right? And all the research behind that, right, amongst the huge level of detail that goes into like high level skill acquisition. But a core component of that is to introduce a little bit of safe failure all mm-hmm. the time, right? Not so out there that you never achieve a goal, but more like a video, like the video games and gambling has it right. Right. You mm-hmm. succeed enough to keep you motivated to want to keep going, mm-hmm. but you don't succeed all the time and develop this false sense of I can accomplish anything anytime I want. So purposefully there is challenge built into that, but not challenge so far away that you can't achieve. Mm-hmm. And if you do that regularly and you, number one, introduce the slightly, you know, goals that are slightly outside of reach. And then a big part of that is, you know, now we go to like servant leadership, or you go to, providing and, developing an environment where you have helped them reach that slightly unattainable goal, either through teaching or coaching or, just a general support system, maybe motivation, something like that. That and you empower them to reach that slightly out there goal regularly and consistently, that they develop this own sense of accomplishment. And I think that's what's missing when you reference the parents that you're talking about that are always providing this cushy, safe, bubble wrapped environment where their kids are always protected. Mm-hmm. Again, like that's a big fear of mine with my son as an only child and everything. Are you always handing him too much where he never experiences that level of safe failure where he develops this self-confidence and this ability to understand that I can work through things, right? Now you go to the Carol Dweck stuff, right? Growth mindset versus fixed mindset. And how do you communicate that work ethic is what helps you succeed, and working through these challenges, that it's not innately wired in you to be successful at hitting a baseball, right? Mm-hmm. You can hit a baseball right now because we've spent time and you've taken a lot of swings, right? And you've listened to your coaches, right? And, you know, it goes back to wiffle ball when you were six, and, you know, now you have some really good coaches that are working on that. And that's the reason why you were good at hitting a baseball at this point in time. It wasn't innately wired in you. You weren't just given that. So you put all those two together and introduce that level of safe failure. And, I think that's the model. I can't tell you I'm doing it right because he's 10 years mm-hmm. old, and mm-hmm. I'm proud. I couldn't be more proud as a father for who he is as a kid, first and foremost, and, you know, his level of interest in sports and all that stuff. So I hope, like every other parent, you hope you're doing it right. I'm mm-hmm. sure I'm making a ton of mistakes too, like many others, but that's the approach, you know, and I would categorize that under like a safe level of failure.
Yeah. I like that. Just to unpack that a little bit more, you know, when you take it back into the performance environment, just curious out of your experience, because you've worked at the highest levels and seen, you know, almost the highest measure of how you can do things. Do you think that there's we're building environments that are too insulated in some sense, that they're too, all of that is just too forgiving, you know, and again, I come back to that story of, you know, you look at the Jamaican sprint team, and if you go to Jamaica and you see the, you know, where they train and the equipment and the track that they have, and it's nothing like you would see at most NCAA schools, mm-hmm. but they keep preparing some of the finest sprinters in the world as an example, right? So mm-hmm. is there some level of austerity, not, you know, but in some ways we've created these immaculate environments with these immaculate performance teams, etc. And it almost seems like there's nothing, to your point, that safe level of failure almost mm-hmm. becomes impossible to derive, but it also becomes an expectation of the athlete as they move from team to team to team. So any thoughts on, do you think that there's a point of, hey, we have to not have every bell and whistle because we also have to sometimes dig a ditch, if you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I 100% agree with you. I think there is an element of that, right? The arms race that is recruiting and luring free agents and all that stuff, like it does. It's an environment of one where if you are missing a lot of those bells and whistles, you are clearly seen as inferior and you may not get the guys, Mm-hmm. Right. So there is that external pressure that, you know, we collectively, the entire sports world has really just put on ourselves. Right. Right. It's just, I got to do one better than the next guy with respect to big flashy facilities and amenities and technology and equipment and everything. So I agree with you. That's out there. I think the only, but you can't not have it. That's right. The problem, right? That's the challenge. So I think the way you manage that is, again, like, it's all like balance. We don't want two extremes of any one thing. So you have to find ways to maybe like ground guys here and there and remind them. And I think some of the stuff we did really well with the Sixers was, you bring guys in, right? In influences, successful guys. It was one thing that Coach Brown was amazing at was not just growing guys with respect to basketball, but also feeling an obligation and a responsibility to help them grow as others with respect to the world and other things. So we brought in a lot of really high level speakers, right? And you're talking about like naval commanders and guys that spent time incarcerated, and, you know, you go to the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, right? And that somber environment, you actually see and understand the power that comes with, you know, the ceremonies that they do there and everything. And you constantly remind guys that there's a world outside of this cushy, you know, logos all over the walls and any piece of technology that you want to monitor load and everything like that, that there is a whole other world out there that you should constantly be reminded of, that this is, and by the way, this time in the NBA, as many of us know, and any pro league, is it's fleeting. You're not going to have this forever. Right. Mm-hmm. And at some point, you know, recognize roots, recognize that other people have different challenges. Coach would talk about just the city of Philadelphia and the blue collar nature of the fan, and, you know, we talk about this all the time, the financial commitment to go to a game, and what does that mean for a father of four that just wants to, you know, the responsibility you have to work hard that evening for that guy that works so hard just to buy tickets to bring his family to a game. And if you can introduce, again, like, the relationship part of it is really important first, but if you can continue to those subtle reminders and all that stuff, that that there's a whole other world out there after, I think that's a way to balance it. Again, I can't mm-hmm. tell you that's the only way to do that, mm-hmm. but you know, reminders of, you know, bring a guy, like we did this a couple, you know, that Philadelphia is known for the art museum. Like, we had our, you know, you do a workout on the art museum stairs with very little equipment, and right. And then you bring them to the North Philadelphia gym with that, you know, a ton of, like, you know, successful boxers came through in Philadelphia, and you grind it out in a boxing gym one day. Right. And it's just a little mm-hmm. subtle reminder of, you know, how other people train sometimes. That could be a way to manage that as one potential solution.
Cool.
Yeah.
I'm going to read from this little piece I do in my book. There's a book called The Day You Were Born that was written by Linda Joyce. She's an astrologer, and she combined numerology with astrology, and I found my purpose in that book. So it may or may not resonate with you, but I have fun with it anyway. So you were born February 20th. Is that correct?
Correct.
Correct. So Pisces 2 you are. Your purpose is to harness your excessive compassion and learn how to say no and set boundaries so that you can experience intimacy without fear and allow your creativity to blossom. Many a man fails to become a great thinker only because his memory is too good. Friedrich William Nietzsche. Pisces 2s need to learn how to empty themselves and let go of the past. Their memories are strong, and so are their anger and feelings of abandonment. They have had to learn how to nurture themselves and stand on their own two feet. Pisces 2s yearn for a soulmate, either because they have never had the intimacy and closeness they desire, or because they have once felt very connected to someone and are eager to experience that again. Either way, the Pisces 2 needs to know that being on the earth plane means living with divine discontent. Nothing will ever be perfect. Pisces 2s are exceptionally sensitive, psychic, and creative. Their will and resistance gets them into trouble. They must learn to be flexible and forgive those who have hurt them. Music may delight the Pisces too. They could be talented artists or at least appreciative of the works of geniuses. Pisces twos are extreme in nature. They are loners and need space because they absorb the energy around them. They must learn to mediate and set up boundaries without having to remove themselves from life. Others come to them for advice. They have great depth and big hearts. Don't know if any of that sticks for you.
Yeah, no, it's really interesting. I appreciate you reading that. Yeah. Some of it appropriate for sure. Some of it I'd probably push back on a little bit.
As everybody does for sure.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah, there's lots of play with in there. I want to sort of bring this to a conclusion around your book. Again, for the listener, you wrote a book called The Intent is to Grow. I assume you can get this
on Amazon.
Perfect.
Just do a search for the title and it'll pop right up, both the Audible version and I'm sorry, not Audible, ebook version and paperback. Yeah.
So, you know, I think we spun a little bit of a yarn here through your life and sort of understand where, and this kind of is where I'd like you to finish the thread a bit, is this book is really about EQ and your personal growth and connecting with who you are as a human being and that sort of stuff. And I sort of prefaced this question with, you know, in these environments today, there's so much technology, there's so many bells and whistles, there's so much of that. How does the young person or the older person actually say, you know what, I know all this stuff is good, but I'm not going to let it be a crutch. I'm going to work on my EQ. I'm going to work on who I am. I'm going to work on being a better teammate, a better communicator, a better connector in the space, etc. I'm not going to defer to the technology or the simple, you know, easy fix kind of situation. So I'm kind of curious how your take on that and what the mission of the book really is.
Yeah. I think the first, maybe the most powerful thought behind, you know, just acknowledging the skill set is that I really think they become the differentiators, right? So similar that we would tell a professional athlete that, look, everyone is athletically gifted up here. You wouldn't be in this building. You wouldn't be at this level. We would not have drafted you if you couldn't play basketball. So let's understand that. Everyone can play ball at this level. It's the other things that are going to make you stand out. Your commitment to your training, your commitment to your body and your nutrition, diligence in all of your, you know, rehab and prehab and taking care of your body and all that stuff and film study. And those are going to be the differentiators, not your genetic ability to play basketball. Everybody has that, right? How are you going to grow that? And not the least of which is more, you know, a work ethic on the court, right? To take your natural ability and grow that and get better. So as we would call those the differentiators for an athlete, I would say the same thing to a young practitioner that has aspirations to work in a high level Division I environment, an Olympic, right? An Olympic sport environment or an institute of sport somewhere in any of the countries or a professional environment, that teams are not going to hire somebody, you know, especially the nature of advanced degrees right now. You have strength coaches that have PhDs and, you know, DPTs and all that stuff. Like there is firepower and intelligence at high levels for sure. It's kind of a guarantee. The differentiators become this skill set. And while you are going after all of the technical knowledge and your additional certifications, which again, to me, it's not a hierarchy. It's not like abandon one and do the other. There's a place at the table for all of these, and just make sure you acknowledge and find ways to grow this skill set as well. And then that's what's really going to help you stand out. You're going to earn respect. You're going to get recognition from your peers and athletes and coaches, right? And when the time comes, you're going to get the referrals and you're going to be the one that people think of when a job comes up for a promotion, either internally or internally within the organization, or a new gig comes up where you want to jump from head man, that these are the real ways that that you become the person that's sought out and thought of for sure. And once you recognize that, now you say, okay, cool, how can I go and get better at those, right? And modeling is a good one. You're probably going to work with people that have been in the current environment for a sustained period of time. And they're probably one that probably is pretty good at this skill set. So you start to observe and you start to watch and you start to, you know, see how the successful people do it. Mm-hmm. And then there are ways to develop, you know, empathy and compassion, right? And it's sometimes it's just as simple as saying, okay, if the first component of empathy, as it's defined in the research, right, Goleman and Ekman and everything, is a cognitive empathy. It's just like recognition that I'm going to pay a little bit of attention to this other person and their needs. Maybe it's just as simple as when you're in there, you're not always talking shop. It's not all about just sets and reps and movement patterns, that you spend some time engaging with the person as a human being, mm-hmm. right? And you recognize that everybody has goals and values and aspirations and strengths and weaknesses. And it's our inherent human nature to want to have those recognized. Mm-hmm. And if you apply that to your athletes, now you're a better connector. Now you're a good human being, and it just strengthens the relationship and it empowers you to do your job, all of the technical stuff, even more. Yeah. Right. And that's just one small example. So you take that, you know, and there's ways to become better communicators, and there's certainly ways that you can, you know, grow, you know, tons of articles and research and YouTube videos on how to become a better leader and take a transformational approach. And, you know, there's ways that you can grow that, but it starts with recognizing that it's a skill set that should be grown right alongside mm-hmm. of your mm-hmm. technical knowledge. Yeah.
Beautiful. That's a great way to wrap this puppy up. For the listener again, Jesse Wright, he's written a book called The Intent is to Grow. You can get it on Amazon.com. And really pleased we had a chance to catch up and I got a chance to learn more of your story, Jess. And hopefully this is not the last time we connect. And in this world of COVID, hopefully coming to an end, hopefully it'll be live versus on this internet portal, so to speak.
Yeah, I hope so too. That would be amazing. And just huge appreciation and thank you for the chance to catch up and talk and everything. This was awesome. I love talking about the topic. Like you said, the opportunity to reconnect, just all amazing stuff. So thank you for that.
Thanks, Jess. Have a great day.
You too.
Thanks for joining us today on Leave Your Mark. I hope we've left a mark on you today, and we wish only that you pay it forward by sharing this story, taking the time to rate and comment on this podcast. Please follow us at Twitter at Built by Scott and Instagram at King O'Payne, and become a member of this community at Scott G. Livingston on Facebook. Have a great day. Music by Cedric de Saint-Rome.